After the Great Recession, private investors bought millions of American homes.
Those letters said to me, they're going to put a tenant in here, and it's either going to be you, and you're going to agree to their terms, or it's going to be somebody else, and we don't really care.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for December 17th, a look at who really controls the real estate market in the United States. Also on the show, Republicans and Democrats are finding common ground on an issue that everyone can agree is just plain annoying.
Through November of this year, there are already 54 billion robocalls to Americans.
Plus, why some journalists are taking issue with how the new Richard Jewell film depicts a woman reporter. All right, let's get started. A decade ago, the United States was rocked by a foreclosure crisis in the wake of the Great Recession. Real estate prices plummeted and credit markets all but froze, with many banks reluctant to sell mortgages. But for cash buyers, the glut of cheap property was an appealing investment opportunity. And some of the biggest beneficiaries of the flush housing market were private investors who began buying homes in the millions. Sandy Jolly was one of the nearly 10 million Americans who lost their homes between 2006 and 2014. A bank foreclosed on her Los Angeles property in 2013.
We just walked around the house, you know, remembering how long my parents had been there, how much they loved that house, how proud they were of that house. I was thinking of all the memories.
When the house was sold at auction, the new owners offered Sandy to stay, but this time as a renter.
Those letters said to me, they're going to put a tenant in here, and it's either going to be you, and you're going to agree to their terms, or it's going to be somebody else, and we don't really care.
And Sandy's story is all too common. A shell company called Colfin AI5 California LLC had bought the deed for her home in an all-cash transaction. According to the Census Bureau, after the recession, almost 3 million homes and 13 million apartments had been bought by similar entities like LLCs, LLPs, and other obscure investment vehicles. Now, new reporting from Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting has peeled back a layer of the corporate facade that conceals who really owns the U.S.'s housing stock. According to Reveal, these essentially anonymous owners decrease the number of affordable houses on the market and can spell trouble for tenants and communities. And now Reveal is suing the Treasury Department to get the identities of the wealthy investors behind these shell companies. Joining me now is Aaron Glantz, senior reporter at Reveal and author of the new book, Homewreckers. Aaron, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
So why were these shell companies buying up all these properties? Was it just a question of the availability and the affordability of these properties?
Well, I mean, they had cash at a time, as you said in your intro, the banks weren't lending. They came in, you had millions of homes all across the country, the banks were foreclosing on people, and there were folks with ready cash. The guy who bought Sandy's home, I write in my book, Homewreckers, Tom Barrack, Donald Trump's closest friend, who introduced Ivanka at the Republican convention and planned Trump's inauguration, buys 30,000 homes all over the country. The Guardian and the Washington Post unmasked Sean Hannity as a big buyer of homes throughout the American South, the Fox News personality. But each one of these revelations was a tremendous investigative news effort because we had to figure out who owned Colfin AI California 5 LLC. What we're saying at Reveal is, you know, we shouldn't have to have some kind of tremendous investigative news effort to find out who's buying up our towns. We should be able to know.
You mentioned Tom Barrack. I want to play a clip from Tom himself speaking at a real estate conference about how he goes about buying up underwater houses. Let's take a listen.
All cash means you have guys walking in, honestly, with bags of cashier's checks because you have no idea what you're going to have to bid. So we have these little 21-year-old kids that are walking in with bags, with Bluetooth on, with cashier's checks in these denominations.
Aaron, you mentioned a bunch of folks, including Sean Hannity and Tom Barrack, who we just heard, who are buying up properties. I mean, is that not a legal strategy?
I mean, there was nothing illegal about what Tom Barrack was doing, and there's nothing illegal about what Sean Hannity is doing. The issue here is transparency. Like, do we have a right to know who our landlords are.
And so if this is a legal strategy, why are they going to such lengths to conceal their identities? That's really what you're trying to get at here.
Yeah, I mean, this is a LLC policy that was, it stands for Limited Liability Corporation, right? And it was created for tax purposes. Actually, it was originally created to shield oil companies who were drilling for oil in Panama from being held accountable in the United States. I mean, it had nothing to do with residential real estate whatsoever in the beginning. But what we see now is people from, you know, Sean Hannity on the one hand to foreign oligarchs on the other hand to just mom and pop landlords who want to conceal themselves and not have the public know that they're buying a particular property. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing if you're Sean Hannity and you turn out to be a slumlord all across the southeastern United States. Maybe if you're going on national television every day showing yourself as a man of the people, right, you might not want people to know that. And then there's other folks who are potentially laundering money through these properties. And this is why the Treasury Department has been collecting this data. I mean, we live in a country now where in big cities like New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Miami, you know, a third of residential purchases are all cash. And the Treasury is telling us that as much as a third of them may have been flagged as suspicious activity. So not all of these cash buys are suspicious, but some of them may be linked to money laundering.
Aaron, I want to talk about, you mentioned the potential for money laundering. Again, not all of this activity is illegal. This is just really an opportunity for folks who have or had cash to go in and buy up. But there is an effect, isn't there, in terms of when you go from being a homeowner, as we heard Sandy at the top of the segment, to suddenly being a renter. What difference does it make if there is a shell company rather than, as you referred to earlier, a real human landlord? Like, what's the concern there?
Who do you call if something goes wrong, right? If you have a problem with your plumbing, if you have roaches, right, you pick up the phone and call the shell company. They probably give you a web portal to go to. But what if you can't satisfy your housing needs with a web portal? What if you want to go up the chain and the only place to go up the chain is a P.O. box in Delaware? Then you're in a world of hurt. In Sandy's case, she went from living in a house that had been bought by her parents back in the 80s for under $90,000 to paying over the course of 18 months more than $40,000 in rent to Tom Barrack's company. They raised her rent three times over those 18 months, and the lease agreement that they made her sign put almost all the maintenance responsibility on her. So if the plumbing burst, she had to fix it. If the window broke, she had to pay for it. But all those rent payments were going to Tom Barrack's shell company, and so he was getting the benefit of all that equity. So that's what happened with her. And then if you're the city and you're dealing with a whole town that is being bought up by shell corporations and you're trying to deal with issue of a housing shortage or systemic blight or your tax policy, but your whole town is being bought up by LLC, LP, and LLP shell companies, then what do you do? Who do you hold accountable? It's unclear.
Well, part of what you're describing, and I've seen this in other parts of the country, is that previously homes that were privately owned, which were caught up in the foreclosure crisis and essentially available, were then scooped up by private companies and now turned into rental properties. Now, I have a question for you, though. If somebody, does someone like Sandy not have a choice to stay and pay the exorbitant rents that you're describing or to move on to a cheaper property?
Well, that's what she eventually did. I mean, she was paying more and more and more rent to the shell company. And eventually, after about a year and a half of this, she moved. And now she's paying rent on another house. And her landlord is a human. And the landlord takes much better care of her. And the rent is lower. So you could say, oh, well, there's a market solution here. But on the other hand, these buyers with ready cash are taking a greater and greater share of the housing inventory of our cities. And this is not something that ended with the housing bust. We're seeing right now, even now with housing prices being so high, an enormous percentage of homes being purchased with cash and held by shell companies. And, you know, there's lots of rumors, right?
But are those shell companies renting those homes after they've been purchased, or are they just holding them Indefinitely.
I mean, I think we have a real mix, right? We have some people who got in, who turned these homes into rentals. But then we look up sometimes at these gleaming new skyscrapers in our major cities, and we see lights that are off at night. And we wonder if there aren't people just parking their money in these buildings. And so even when developers build new housing, it doesn't feel like it's solving our housing crisis. And this is one reason why the transparency, you know, that we're going for in this lawsuit is so important.
Does it matter? I mean, is it the responsibility? Because you're talking about two different things. One are the homes that have already been previously owned and foreclosed on in the wake of the Great Recession. Another thing are new high rises that we see every day here in New York City that are explicitly luxury housing. And so is it the responsibility of the builders of those luxury houses or apartments to provide affordable housing?
Well, I mean, it's the responsibility of our government to give us the information that we need to make good policy, right? I mean, we'll be told like, oh, this new luxury building is going to provide housing. Maybe it'll be for the super rich, but, you know, maybe super rich people are living there. Or what if this building that's going up is half empty and it's just zillionaires parking their money? Right.
What does that do, Aaron, to the fabric of a city? I mean, what's the concern there? Because we do see that quite a bit in luxury housing here in New York City. We know that there are luxury buildings that are going up with 25-year tax abatements, for example. We know that foreign investors in particular have parked a lot of money into these developments, which is a little different than I think what we're describing earlier, which are American homeowners who were caught up in the Great Recession. So is there, what's the impact there?
Yeah, I mean, these two things, they're both coming from the same fountain, right? Which is the complete opaqueness of our system. If you go to other countries like Ukraine, people can go online and look up the jargon is beneficial owner. Who is behind the shell company that owns that building, right? That is not something that we can do in the U.S. So you're asking me to weigh in, right, and discuss the impact of what's happening in our cities because of this incredible growth of shell company ownership, both at the lower and middle class level, where people like Sandy are renting, and in the upper class level on these new condo towers. And I guess what I'm saying is, the reason we're wrestling with this so much and we don't really know is because the government is hiding key information from us.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has been revealed as one of the owners of multiple shell companies here. And you're at the same time, you're suing the Treasury Department for more transparency in getting the information behind these shell companies. Are you worried that there's a conflict of interest there?
Well, I mean, the law says that this information should be released. That's why we're suing. They've been concealing it to us for months. And we first filed our Freedom of Information Act request back in July. They said they could neither confirm nor deny that these records exist. We sent them their own press releases announcing that they were collecting this information. But yeah, it shouldn't be surprising that Steve Mnuchin, who owns property through shell companies, is not terribly excited at releasing this information to the public. As you know, our president, Donald Trump, is the first real estate developer president that we've had. He owns real estate through more than 300 shell companies. So this is the kind of world that we live in.
Aaron Glantz is a senior reporter at Reveal and author of the new book, Homewreckers. Aaron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Whether they're pretending to be the IRS or offering up free vacations to the Bahamas, robocalls have taken over phones across the United States.
Hello, this is your final notice from card member services. Get your interest rates reduced to as low as 0% on
your
credit card.
Your warranty has expired, and this is a final courtesy call to renew the warranty before we close the file.
According to the Washington Post, Americans received roughly 26.3 billion robocalls in 2018, up 46% from the year before. But relief may be on the way thanks to new federal legislation. 2 weeks ago, the House passed a bipartisan bill that hopes to dial back those pesky calls. It's expected to pass the Senate and could be on the president's desk before Christmas. The Telephone Robocall Abuse Criminal Enforcement and Deterrence Act, also called the TRACED Act, would require service providers to implement new caller authentication technology to be used to block robocalls at no extra cost to consumers. Now, it's unclear exactly how much the bill could do. According to experts, the legislation is more of a speed bump than a silver bullet. For more on this, we turn to Kat Zakreski, a tech policy reporter for The Washington Post, who also writes its Technology 202 newsletter.
We are seeing with this broad influx of calls and complaints from consumers that the federal government is trying to be more active in addressing these. The FCC has been issuing more fines and going after people, but it's kind of an arms race in some ways, right? The technology to prevent these calls gets a little bit better. Government does more to try to address this, and then the bad actors get smarter and find ways to get around that new technology.
How are they getting access to our phone numbers?
There's a variety of ways that phone numbers can be accessed. I mean, if you think about all of the ways that phone numbers are available online, you know, you could do a simple phone book search to find them. And really what we're seeing is that everyone's affected by this. This is something that we've seen come up with 2020 candidates on the campaign trail complaining about receiving robocalls. There have been Capitol Hill hearings where lawmakers say they've been interrupted by having robocallers come to their phones. So, you know, whether you're a politician or just an everyday citizen, everyone knows the annoyance at best that these can cause and at sometimes, you know, outright danger to your hard-earned money.
That is not fair, and it's frustrating for a lot of Americans. Tell me the federal government is going to do more on this. Isn't there legislation?
That's exactly right. There's legislation that recently passed the House with broad bipartisan support. That legislation would give the Federal Communications Commission greater authority to go after these fraudsters and basically allow them to issue larger fines in some instances to crack down on robocalls. It also would require the companies to offer free call blocking and authentication software to consumers, hoping that this legislation would relieve some of the pain that you just talked about experiencing.
What about the phone companies themselves? I mean, what about my wireless carrier provider, the Verizons, the Sprints of the world? Why can't they clamp down on this?
It is something they're increasingly working on. There were some regulatory concerns about them taking action about this. There was a lot of concern about not all auto dial calls are illegal, right? So there was concern that if they took certain steps, it might crack down on totally legitimate uses of robocalls. While, you know, there's a lot of instances where there are legal scams where people are trying to do insurance fraud or steal money, there's also your doctor's office might use auto dialing to remind you of an appointment, or political campaigns might use them to seek contributions. So there was a little bit of concern initially about the companies being too aggressive, but they've taken some steps to, you know, ensure that legitimate callers would be able to lodge a complaint if the software were to crack down on them. So they're now taking more aggressive action at the direction of the FCC and also state's attorney general.
Kat, how quickly should Americans expect to actually see a change in the number of robocalls they're getting? I mean, once the new legislation is passed.
So lawmakers, companies, and FCC regulators are all working in concert to hopefully crack down on these in 2020. You know, we're hearing from them that they're making a broad effort to ensure that we won't see as many robocalls next year. The latest data I've seen said through November of this year, there were already 54 billion robocalls to Americans. And so basically, I think what we'll see play out is an increased effort with this legislation, with the FCC focusing on this more, with companies doubling down to ensure that this happens, because it's bad for the phone companies too to be having so much fraud on their networks. It makes people not trust their phones. So I think the pressure is there certainly for all of these groups to come together and do more to address this issue. And so hopefully that would make a dent in the numbers that we're seeing, but I wouldn't expect robocalls to totally go away anytime soon.
Kat, you're not making me too optimistic here. I mean, I'm wondering, as you mentioned, fraud is a big component of this. If, for example, you know, there are enough people who tell their phone company, look, I keep getting scammed by this entity, do these phone companies stand to be penalized in any way for allowing that on their networks?
That's a really good question. I think that now there's going to be, if this legislation becomes law, there's going to be a lot more pressure on the phone companies to do more to address this issue. And certainly it's an area that the FCC is focusing on a lot more and putting greater pressure on the companies. This is one of those examples where the technology is moving really quickly and the bad actors might be able to move a little bit faster than government. And so it's a real challenge for Washington and the companies to keep up with this issue.
Kat Zakreski is a tech policy reporter at The Washington Post, and she also writes his Technology 202 newsletter. Kat, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
All right, more robocall blues from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Oh my goodness. I get them all. And sometimes all day long, and sometimes even late at night. It's horrible.
Hi, I'm Cecilia calling from Bridgeport, PA. I get spam calls all the time. I get them for fake credit cards and fake debts, money scams, insurance scams, faux emergencies, etc. They really do impact my life. I can never accept calls from numbers not in my contacts. I play phone tag with doctors, coworkers, friends, and distant family members. Real important information gets left to wait because I can't trust my own phone.
Hi, my name is Ricky. I'm calling from Titusville, Florida. I often get robocalls about 3 to 4 a day, and my partner actually gets up to 12 regularly. It's gotten to the point where she needs to actually keep her phone on silent most of the time to keep from disturbing herself during work or school.
Oh my goodness. I get them all. And sometimes all day long, and sometimes even late at night. It's horrible. I hear from the fake IRS, the fake Social Security, the credit card people regarding my Discover card that I don't have, the student loan program for loans that I don't have. I get sometimes 10 a day, and I block them all. I have so many phone numbers blocked. I bet I'm not the only one who would be willing to pay money to get it to stop. This is Julia from Clayton, California.
877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1996, a security guard named Richard Jewell made national headlines after working to clear bystanders during a bombing at Centennial Olympic Park in Atlanta. At first celebrated for his heroism, Jewell soon became the lead suspect in the incident, a fact made public by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He was eventually cleared by the FBI, but not before becoming the center of a national media circus that lasted almost 90 days.
This morning, he was a man with Olympic gold medal hero status, the alert security guard who spotted the deadly backpack and saved lives.
I will say everyone has been very nice.
Tonight, he's the FBI's prime suspect in the Centennial Park bombing.
I'm sure they're investigating everyone that was in the area.
The speculation is that the FBI is close to making the case in their language. They probably have enough to arrest him right now, probably enough to prosecute him, but you always want to have enough to convict him as well. There are still some holes in this case.
At the time, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution was widely criticized for jumping the gun on the story. And now a new film by Clint Eastwood hopes to clear Jewell's name once and for all, but it's being widely criticized for its depiction of Kathy Scruggs, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter who broke the Jewell story. In the film, Scruggs, played by the actor Olivia Wilde, sleeps with an FBI officer to get more information about the case. Joining me now is Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic for Vox. Alyssa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Kathy Scruggs, the AJC reporter, in real life. And we should say that she's deceased.
That's right. She passed away in 2001, about 5 years after the case and before a judge cleared her for what happened in that case. So Kathy Scruggs is described by her colleagues as being kind of a hard-hitting journalist, very fair and equitable, but also kind of a firebrand, very passionate about her work, very good at getting this story, which all of those elements are present in the film for sure. She's a very lively person. But the thing that her colleagues have taken issue with and her former editors have is that she would sleep with a source in order to get information. And of course, this is a trope that happens all the time in the movies, but it's not something that is okay for a journalist to do. And so it's kind of slanderous to a dead journalist.
And we should be clear that why it's not okay for a journalist to do that. I mean, we as journalists and women, but mostly as journalists, have ethical guidelines, right? You want to explain some of those to our listeners?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of ways that you try to get information from people. You do develop relationships with them, but you're not supposed to have that kind of a relationship with a source, and certainly not in order to get information. It's manipulative. It's not an ethical way to do it. And it's not something that journalists, you know, engage in when they're working according to their code of ethics. In the movies, women journalists often are depicted as doing this, but it's not anywhere near as frequent as you might be led to believe by Hollywood.
You say this is a portrayal that we've seen in other media. I recall, I'm thinking about House of Cards, mm-hmm. and the young journalist that we meet in the first season, who sleeps with a source. What are some other examples that we've seen here?
Yeah, there's actually two in House of Cards. It's not just her, but there's another character who says something like, you know, she would sleep with anyone to get information that she needed. Recently in Sharp Objects, the HBO series, there's a depiction of the character Camille doing this. We can go back to the movie Thank You for Smoking. There's a character who does this. Rory Gilmore does on Gilmore Girls. And this is sort of a pattern throughout Hollywood's kind of depiction of female journalists, that this is not just something they do because they want to, but something they do because they're kind of not good enough to do the job without having to get the information that way.
As a woman, as a journalist myself, I've always taken great pains to avoid being in certain situations, right? For example, I tend to do many breakfasts instead of like late night drinks with sources. Do you think this portrayal hurts women journalists in the field?
It definitely does. And women journalists have lots of stories about being expected to maybe give favors to a source or finding themselves in situations that they never intended to become this way. You know, maybe you're talking to a source and then you discover they expect something from you in exchange for the information. Also, there have been very, very recent, even as so far as this week, examples of people saying, oh, well, women do this all the time, right? This is just an expected thing. And so not only does it put you in some situations you don't want to be in, but it also creates the expectation that a woman who is a successful journalist must have slept her way to the top in some way.
How has the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and its parent company, Cox Enterprises, responded to the film so far?
They, even before they saw the film, issued a statement demanding of Warner Brothers, the company that's distributing the film, and Clint Eastwood, and the screenwriter as well, that they make a statement that this is an imaginative recreation of events, that this is not accurate or based on facts, and that they put a statement to that effect in the film as well. And that statement, you know, is a very strongly worded one because they don't want their colleague to be depicted in this way, nor do they want this stereotype to be something that's accepted. They didn't demand that the film be taken, you know, out of theaters, but they did say, we want you to say something about this to make it clear that you made this up.
And also, this raises broader questions about how much artistic license one can take when the subject is a real subject. The people involved are real players. But we're not talking about documentary film here. We're talking about Hollywood. What does that say to you as a critic about how much license Hollywood is allowed to take when it comes to non-documentary films featuring real topics and real people?
Yeah, well, we should say up front that the FBI agent that Scruggs is portrayed as sleeping with is a fictional character or a composite character. So that character that John Hamm plays is not a real guy. However, Kathy Scruggs was a real person. So this actually is where I generally say, you know, license, creativity, you have to tell a story. There are some restrictions that come when you're putting a real story on screen in order to make it exciting and interesting. But why are you taking this real character and having them sleep with a fictional character and having only one of them obviously be culpable in that sense? There's nobody to blame on the other side. So artistic license is great and fine, but we have to think really hard about whether we want to see people be smeared or slandered on screen in the name of artistic license, and also the context in which that artistic license is presented.
Alyssa Wilkinson is film critic for Vox. Alyssa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.